Hey, everybody, this is Left, Right, and Center. I am David Greene, and thank God the suspense is over. We now know that Donald Trump and Joe Biden have clinched their party nominations and will be running in a rematch for the presidency this fall. This, of course, really wasn't news. It's been obvious for months and months, but it was still all over the news. And, you know, that was largely force of habit for news organizations, also probably the lure of ratings for some cable channels. And if it annoyed you, it is far from the only complaint out there about how the media is treating these candidates that they have had years of practice covering. In 2016, safe to say it seemed like the media didn't really know how to cover Donald Trump. In the run-up to that election, as we went through the primary process, the conventions, the debates, a lot of people really never seemed to take Trump all that seriously. The focus really was on Hillary Clinton, this career politician running a flawed campaign, and the flaws were put on full display in the media. Well, now, 2024, a lot has changed, and dare I argue, a lot has improved in the press since then. But Democrats are still seeing reporters, in their view, making the same mistakes again when it comes to Biden's age. And you also have a lot of Republicans who see reporters worried about doing or saying anything that could favor Donald Trump. So with that, here I am, the reporter, the journalist, jumping into the fray on this topic with our regular Left, Right, and Center panel. We have Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch. She is a lawyer with spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. And we have Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was communications director for the Democratic National Committee and advisor to the candidate I just mentioned a few seconds ago, Hillary Clinton, back in the day. So want to talk about the media, you two?
Always.
Let's do it.
Always. I guess I think what feels different in 2024, I'll just throw this out there to get things started, is the fact that the stakes are not something that the media risks seeming to be like overstating. I mean, I think back in 2016, once we realized that Donald Trump, you know, was the candidate, there was a sense of, you know, in the media of like, oh, my God, do you all understand who this is? Do you all understand the dangers, the risks? And it came across as so biased. And I think right now we are hearing from the candidate himself, you know, sort of the vision he has for a second term. And you don't have to risk hyperbole when you were saying and speaking to voters and framing the election as a very stark choice about your hopes and views of the kind of system of government you want in your country. That's where I'll start. But, you know, I've more to say. What are you both thinking about right now?
We're in a place right now where I think there are good, solid journalists out there who want to cover politics and the moment we live in earnestly. But at the same time, the business model of the media is to appeal to your viewers, to your readers. And so you oftentimes see you see this dynamic play out in real time where they are covering stories the way their predetermined audience would want them covered. And that just creates alternate realities that America lives in. I remember, as many of our listeners know, I used to be a Democratic contributor at Fox News. I remember the day the Mueller report came out, I spent half the day watching CNN and MSNBC's coverage of it, and I was convinced the president was about to get hauled out of the Oval Office in handcuffs. And then that evening, I went into Fox News, and before I went on, I was standing in the green room, which was full of conservative talking heads, and they were all high-fiving each other, screaming, "Total exoneration." It was the same series of words on the same pieces of paper.
Yeah, and hasn't changed since then. I mean, and that
but it, that if, alternate reality has made it very, very complicated for people who want to consume straight news about politics today.
And that is, and Sarah, I want to let you jump in, but Mo, I think you're speaking to what I'm hoping can change this year, that we don't have just one story after the next where you have different versions of that story all hyped up on different networks and news organizations that it, just everyone is like jumping to say the next thing, the next headline. I mean, we saw that this week with just the overhype over, you know, the two candidates getting their nominations. Who cares?
Good luck with that, David.
I know, but there's a way that if enough of us, and I agree with you, because I have a lot of colleagues, and I include myself in this group, people who do earnestly want to cover this election, quote unquote, in the right way. I think there are ways to do it, to get away from sort of the every moment and every development. We have these two candidates. We have a choice. The stakes are very high. What can we do to convey those stakes to voters, convey what this choice means, to give them, to equip them with the information they need to make a decision that is really, really important. But Sarah, let me let you jump in.
So, like with Mo, I think I would say, that's a real nice dream you have, David. Boy, should this week wake you up into the reality of what the next 6 months are going to be like. My experience, by the way, I'll just go back to the Mueller report, which is what Mo was talking about. So I was, you know, in the Department of Justice, and to watch these news organizations cover it before the release. I'm talking about just sort of the hype on, you know, all of these outlets. You should know that behind the scenes, off the record, or on deep background, I was telling them, stop. You don't have the facts that you think you have. You're misreading things. Let me tell you the only things that you should be looking at. And it didn't matter. And I think that what that points to for me is something that I talk about a lot in the law context, that there are judges who are consequentialists, and there are judges who are very not consequentialist. And it doesn't make one or the other in the judicial context necessarily bad. It depends which consequences I think that you're worried about. Are you worried about whether lower courts are going to be able to follow your opinion, for instance, things like that. But what I've noticed from some reporters over the years is that they think about the consequences of their reporting, which I think is incredibly dangerous. And I think it's the number one thing that's led to a deterioration in the credibility of the media. Because there was one news story that I was working on, and a reporter from a major news outlet called and said, you know, we're working on this, but we're obviously pretty worried because if we publish, it would help Trump.
They said, the reporter said those words to you. I mean, that.
Yeah,
or something like that. I mean, that their intention was
it was word for word
to be very careful in doing something that would support Trump.
Yeah, this was said in a really sincere way. Like, I want to convey to you that this wasn't meant to be snarky or whatever else. Like, he was trying to make the point that like they really wanted to get the story right,
mm-hmm.
but the reason they really wanted to get it right was because it would help Donald Trump. And I think that listeners and viewers can sense that and intuit that. And this week was another great example of that, where you had some journalists going out there and saying, the transcript shows that Biden had no memory lapses whatsoever and that the special counsel lied in the report. When in fact, and you had, of course, on the right, you know, Biden is a vegetable and he's totally guilty or whatever. And in fact, I think you earn a lot of credibility with people when you say, the transcript has a little bit of both, and it's a really close call how you're going to feel after you read the transcript. I'd encourage you to read it, and here's, you know, some representative chunks. And a lot of news outlets did do that. I want to give that credit. But here's the problem. After so many years of consequentialism journalism, you've created consequentialist viewers and listeners so that I'll just repeat this story to you guys because it's so funny to me. David French in the New York Times endorsed Joe Biden this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a podcast, a legal podcast with David French, where we were breaking down some of the, you know, weaknesses in the cases against Trump and some of the strengths in what the special counsel was pointing out against Biden. And we got an email from someone that basically said, how dare you? You are not nearly anti-Trump enough. Just because you endorse Biden doesn't mean that you can say things like this that could help Trump.
See, and that is where I have a couple things I want to say. One, it really hits me hard that a reporter would say, I am fact-checking because I want to be careful before I publish something that would support Donald Trump. I remember those days, like, my colleagues and I would take extra care in fact-checking when it came to Trump stories because he and his team lied so much. That to me is okay. But if someone stated that the intention was, I don't want to do a story that could favor Trump, like, I have a problem with that. But you said something really important, like the audience, people who are consuming the news can intuit and can see this consequentialist kind of thing going on. I don't think...
And then they want it.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I don't think recognizing the consequences of decisions in an election is okay. To me, what reporters can't do, because an audience will pick up on it, is judging people for making a decision and conveying in the coverage like, oh my God, why would you support a guy like this? How could you possibly support Donald Trump? Aren't you stupid? And a like, this is really bad for you and your life. Like, you don't you need to know this about the Mueller report? Like, the Mueller report should have made it clear to you that, like, there were ties to Russia. Like, this is really scary. That all's bad. And I think people who consume media pick up on it. But there are ways now in 2024 to do that differently, which is to say, like, your voters, we believe in a democracy and a free press because we're journalists. This election is consequential. Donald Trump says what his plans are. And we are saying we're committed to a democracy. You American voters have a choice. Here's the choice. This is what's at stake. Like, there are ways to tell that story without a sense of judgment and hysteria.
I want to clarify something, though. I meant reporters worried about the consequences of their own stories,
yeah.
i.e., if I publish this story, it will help
yes.
X or Y. It will have the result of X or Y. Not talking about consequences
yeah, no.
of...
Totally
world
fair.
Events,
yeah,
to be clear.
I just want to make that distinction.
Yeah.
I know you. Yeah.
And the only other second thing that I would just clarify really quickly is because so often we, you know, blame Congress or we blame candidates or we blame reporters, when in fact, at the end of the day, the American people had a choice in the primaries. They have a choice of what news to listen to. They have a choice not to send an email that says endorsing Joe Biden isn't enough if you say that Donald Trump might be right about something. That's on you all listening, not us.
Although it's on reporters to not cave to the pressure of getting, you know, emails like that. I mean,
remember in the wake of the 2020 election, when Fox News was the first outlet in the nation to call the state of Arizona for Joe Biden, they received a firestorm of criticism from the MAGA crowd. And what happened? Viewers started flocking to Newsmax. They started flocking to One America News Network and to other right-wing pro-MAGA media outlets. And Fox, which had dominated the cable news landscape for well over a decade, suddenly, for the first time, saw its numbers dropping precipitously to the point where, like, CNN and MSNBC were starting to leapfrog it in some time slots.
Wait, don't
right
forget the
that,
one other reaction that they had. They fired Chris Steigerwalt, who was the guy who actually
made
the
right.
call. So they also sent a message to their internal staff.
Well, but that was that's the chain reaction, right? They did something. Their viewers started moving away from them. So what do? They fired the guy that made the call, and they started to change their coverage.
Yeah, you
at
caved
the
to
time,
pressure.
At the time, I was doing four or five appearances on Fox News a week. My Twitter trolls started coming at me saying very frequently, I don't know why Fox has you on. You should go to CNN or MSNBC where you belong.
Right. And that...
Right? The viewers saying, I don't want to hear that perspective here. MSNBC viewers say the same thing if a pro-Trump voice comes on the network. And so the network responds.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's a real problem. The journalistic side says that they should do the right thing, but the business side wants to make sure that they are giving their viewers, their readers, what they're looking for.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back to talk more about this. Mo and Sarah and I will be right back with more Left, Right, and Center.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
We are back with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green with Moa Lathy and Sarah Isger talking about the media, journalists, and how we are going to cover the 2024 presidential election. Here's my question. Like, I, as a journalist, believe in democracy. I support democracy. I am a...
Good for you.
I believe in a free press. I believe in democracy. I think that Donald Trump is very transparently and pretty brazenly acting anti-democratic in a lot of ways right now when he talks about his plans to dismantle institutions, to pack the federal bureaucracy with people who support him. I mean, he has praised authoritarian leaders around the world. So I think the bind that a lot of journalists are in is how can we be passionate believers in democracy and not be biased in a presidential election. And that's what I come back to, what you both keep telling me is this pipe dream, but that I'm not going to let it go, that it is possible for some journalists, you know, some to not cave to pressure from their echo chamber audiences, not cave to pressure from what is the successful business model, and cover this election in a way that says, I believe in democracy, but one of the core principles of democracy is voters get to decide. So I will, till the last day, describe the stakes of this election and say these are the two leaders and philosophies and styles of government that you have before you. It is your choice. And there it is. And focus more on that than covering this election in the predictable way that we have for one election after another. This is not the same. The stakes are higher and there's a way to find this balance. But do you agree? I mean, can you believe in democracy without being pro-Biden?
So, David, one, you've got a business model problem. And I don't mean there isn't a business model for what you're talking about, but it's a specific business model with a specific audience. And there's a whole business model that's much larger for what you're not talking about. Because, again, I'm going to blame listeners and viewers here. They're rewarding the bad on both sides. So that's number one. Number two, I would just say that it's important to have a certain amount of intellectual humility, that the moment you're living in and that the thoughts that you're having and that the existential crisis you think you're in may not be what you think it is. It might be. Intellectual humility isn't, I'm probably wrong. It's just, I might be wrong. Being open to the possibility that you're wrong.
So what are you saying that about this moment and me? Because I'm a big believer in intellectual humility, obviously. So
the United States survived the Wilson administration. He threw 1,000 people in jail for speaking out against his government. He believed in eugenics. He was a notorious racist and anti-Semite. Not only did we survive the Wilson administration, you know, he was heralded as one of the best presidents in the United States' history for a long time.
Well, let's tell that story instead of spending time focusing on who's gotten the primary win in Michigan. I mean, I love that. I'm with you.
Yes, and we do. But my point is, like, it can be okay in the end as well. And I think the hyperventilation, you know, that, and we've seen this, and it gets to point number three. So I'll just move to point number three, which is, it is hard to earn back credibility. So when you thought the sky was falling with George W. Bush, who was a racist, and then McCain, and then Romney, yeah, you've already lost credibility. And the media did that. When the, you know, media hyperventilated in 2016 and 2020, and again, I'm not even saying it was not well-deserved, but you lose credibility when, like, it's already gone. You're trying to earn back credibility, which is so, so much harder. I'm remembering, again, this moment at the Department of Justice. And remember, the White House hates me. The administration hates me. The Republicans hate me. The Democrats hate me. Everyone hates me.
You're
because
real popular.
I'm real popular when I'm at DOJ because I just refuse to not give reporters not just truthful information, but fulsome information, the entire picture as I know it, to the extent I am allowed to share it, you know, because of national security or, you know, classification stuff. And I so remember, I mean, mind you, I believe there were four times that the White House tried to fire me. But there's one time I remember after several of those times, three of them maybe, in which I got a call asking me to work on a specific story because the White House press staff couldn't do it. They didn't have credibility to do it anymore because they'd lied so many times. So they actually needed someone to just, you know, convince this reporter of the truth, which was in fact accurate, but their own people couldn't do it. And that's the concern, I think, for reporters. You're talking about people who, some of whom have already lost their credibility, or they're in a business model where they don't want their credibility. And the real question you should be asking is, how do you get that credibility back? Not how do you start from zero now? Because you're not at zero now.
You know, we all remember those polls, right? Like, what do earnest journalists like you, David, do, right? We all remember those polls back when Obamacare was dominating the news. If you called something Obamacare, its approval rating was like in the toilet. But if you started talking about what the individual components were, you saw its approval rating go up. And I wonder if, as someone who believes in the role of the media, as someone who believes the media should be doing what you're talking about doing in terms of this election,
yeah,
maybe not put a stamp on it, maybe not put a label on it, maybe just report what Donald Trump is doing. Because the second you say Donald Trump is anti-democratic, you immediately are going to feed into this narrative. But if you just say, here are all the things Donald Trump wants to do, I think a lot of listeners just hear it very differently. But that's not what we see, right? We watch any news organization, and that's immediately where they go. Donald Trump is anti-democratic, and here are the proof points. Just give people the proof points, and I think you would see a different reaction a lot of the times.
Yeah, I really hear you on that. And I think that speaks to one other core important principle slash question here, and that is trust in our audience. I mean, I look back to, you know, and you brought up the sky is falling under George W. Bush, Sarah. Like, I would quibble with that for some journalists because, you know, for example, in the build up to the Iraq War, I mean, I had to go interview lots of voters about what they thought. And they would say things to me like, well, you know, Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And I would do my job, which I thought was to present the facts and to tell a voter and say there is no evidence of that, even though that's what you're hearing from, you know, the Bush administration. It wasn't my job to act like the world is falling, that the Iraq War, if it happens, is going to tear the world apart. But it was to present the facts and to present a reality and to trust voters that they would, once they learn what they heard from me, make their decision. And I think today there's an element of that. But I like what you're saying, Mo, because there's a way to say these are Donald Trump's plans. These are the people that he idolizes. Like, this is what past presidents in the United States have done when they've done things like you're hearing Trump talk about, without putting a label on it and saying, don't you see that democracy is going to be torn apart? And I appreciate that distinction.
Here's what you and Mo are missing. In every single answer that you've given, you've talked about Donald Trump. And I do not think you will have credibility unless you recognize the inherent weaknesses in Joe Biden as a candidate, in the failures of Biden's presidency, and in the real concerns that Trump voters have about Biden. If you're not willing to talk about those things as well, you will not have credibility. If you're only talking about Donald Trump, and I don't mean equating the two, I don't mean both sides-isms. I mean actually laying out, here are the concerns, here are the things that Joe Biden has done that have broken norms, here are the things that Donald Trump have broken norms. And it's okay if you believe that one of those is far worse than the other. But if you're unwilling to say that Joe Biden has broken norms, if you're unwilling to say that he's done some of the same stuff that you freaked out when Trump, and I don't mean you, that one freaked out about when Trump did it during his presidency, you will not have credibility with a whole swath of voters.
I don't disagree with that, but I do think that where it gets complicated, and you brought this up, Sarah, right? Like, one of the problems that people on the left have with the media is they feel that the media too often rushes to both sides every issue, where there may not be two different sides to an issue. But problem number two is, even when the media does what you're suggesting, Sarah, I don't think they get credit for that from Trump voters, right? You talk to anyone on the left and they will say, what are you talking about? Look at the breathless coverage of Robert Herr's report and the way the media seized on the one line about Joe Biden and his age and his mental acuity. Or what are you talking about? Look at the way the media covered breathlessly Hillary Clinton's emails or the Jim Comey letter in the final days of that campaign. There is a sense out there that there is a different standard, right? By both sides. Both sides out there believe that there is a different standard by which their side is covered. But this notion that the media does not cover the left or cover Joe Biden or cover Hillary Clinton with the same fervor that they cover Donald Trump, I don't think that's wholly accurate.
All right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. So we're talking about the media coverage of Donald Trump, Joe Biden. Mo, as you were just digging into, and I want to bring up something that we've sort of been alluding to, which I think is a pretty good case study this week in what we've been talking about, and that is the special counsel's testimony, Robert Herr. I mean, so he came out with a report. He was looking into Joe Biden's handling of classified documents from his time as vice president. He said that he was not suggesting charges in part because he found Biden to be an elderly man with poor memory. And as you were suggesting, Mo, the media has gone, you know, has been twisted up over how to cover this. They've gotten a lot of criticism. And we saw this hearing on the Hill. We saw Republicans outraged that Herr didn't think Biden should be charged after everything we saw with Trump and classified documents. And we saw Democrats outraged that Herr decided to criticize Biden's age and mental acuity, and we ended up in this mess where everyone seemed to be in their echo chambers, and people on the Hill just seemed to be trying to score political points, and there we are. You both described this as both parties playing political ping pong with the special counsel. Sarah, what did you see play out this week, and what should we take from it so maybe we can all, as both journalists, lawmakers, everyone, handle a moment like this a little differently next time?
So first of all, worth noting, again, I worked with Rob Herr at the Department of Justice. He was overseeing the Mueller investigation. He's the only special counsel, only person to have worked on both the Mueller investigation that declined to recommend charges against Donald Trump and the Biden investigation that declined to recommend charges against Joe Biden.
You worked with him, and we should say that there were some reports out there that made some news saying that you, a former Trump official, were helping Robert Herr prep for his testimony about Biden. I mean, can you clear that up? What if any involvement did you have in getting the special counsel ready to testify?
Zero. After the report came out, I talked to Rob Herr. He asked whether I'd be interested in helping, and then we both decided like not to do it. So yeah, that
you were
wasn't
not involved
through.
In prepping him.
I was not involved.
Okay. Carry on. Carry on.
But yeah, so David, I think this is such a good example of partisan brain at work, and also where I thought the media actually missed some good opportunities to point out the logical problems with partisan brain. So let's take each side. Democrats were sitting at that hearing over and over again trying to make the point that Biden had zero memory problems, that the special counsel's report had lied, had misled the American people. And to be clear, the reason that the special counsel included three paragraphs out of 218 pages on Biden's memory was as one of the four reasons that he believed a jury might not convict Joe Biden. So, by Democrats making the point that Joe Biden has no memory problems, the logical conclusion of that is, so see, you should have charged him, which is dumb. On the Republican side, you had Republicans making the point that Joe Biden absolutely should have been charged. And I should footnote this. I mean, recommend charges. You can't charge a sitting president, yada, yada. Anyway, so Republicans out there, obviously you had the evidence. Beyond a reasonable doubt, you should have brought charges. Look at all this evidence. To be clear, there are a lot of similarities between the Trump and Biden cases, and there's a lot of differences. But if you're going to argue that there was sufficient evidence to recommend charges against Joe Biden, you are certainly agreeing that there was sufficient evidence to recommend charges against former President Donald Trump, which obviously is not what Republicans wanted to be making is their main point. And so again and again, you had both sides in their sort of partisan way thinking they were scoring points. And I thought it would have been really effective if reporters had sort of taken that aspect to it to point out the failures of that logic on both sides rather than try to referee the game, if that makes sense.
It's so funny. I don't think I disagree with anything you said, Sarah, but I kind of internalized the coverage a little bit differently. Republicans spent most of their time, as I watched the hearings, trying to do two things. One, call into question the president's memory. They were leaning very, very, very heavily, probably on balance more so, on his mental acuity. And second, trying to make the argument that there is a two-tiered system of justice. Book, why is it that Donald Trump was prosecuted but not Joe Biden? Democrats, on the other hand, spent, I thought, most of their time screaming exoneration, screaming, no, reminding people that no charges were brought, that the president didn't do anything wrong here, which, incidentally, I think was the smart thing for them to do. When you watch the coverage afterwards, it was all that. Here's what Republicans tried to do. Here's what Democrats tried to do. The person who got the least coverage was Robert Hur.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and that was great for him. That was by design. I remember seeing several news accounts that said Robert Hur wanted to come in, not make any news. He succeeded in not making any news. So let's talk about what the Democrats and Republicans were trying to do to each other, which then turned it into a campaign thing as opposed to a serious conversation about the fact that Robert Hur didn't make any news, that he just answered the questions.
Well, I'm going to, and we have to move on in a second, but I just want to say, kind of wrapping all this up, there are different ways to cover a moment like this. I look at a story in Slate that I'm just pulling it up right now. It said that Hur exaggerated and misrepresented multiple statements in an obvious effort to depict the president as a senile geezer unfit for office. I look at that and I distinguish it from what I saw from really, to me, solid and nuanced reporting in the New York Times, which took pains to show excerpts of the transcripts. I mean, where Biden in those moments did, you know, seemed to really struggle with memory, seemed to be all over the place, but also pointed out that there were moments throughout the transcript where he seemed on top of everything. That's the level of nuance and facts. It's not putting labels on it, like you said, Mo, not saying Trump is undemocratic. It's not saying that Hur was trying to make Biden seem like a senile geezer. It's like presenting what happened in a way that's compelling, that's interesting, that captures the stakes of the moment, but also doesn't fall into the trap of seeming like you're playing to your echo chamber. All right. Mo and Sarah and I are going to be back in just a minute, and we are going to talk about New York City and the National Guard being deployed in the subway system. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green with Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch, and Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown's Institute of Politics and Public Service. You know, we've talked about crime on our show. I mean, it's a huge issue for a lot of Americans right now. It's a big issue in the presidential campaign. You know, one important thing, the big role that voters' perception of crime could play in this election season, whether crime rates are actually going up, down, you know, perception can be important when it comes to politics. And that's really come up recently in the Big Apple, New York City, where we're turning our attention this week for our 50 states project. This is where we are going to visit all 50 states throughout this campaign season to look at a local story and see what we can learn about our national political conversation. So the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, recently announced a 5-point proposal that's aimed at increasing public safety, especially on New York City's massive transit system. This proposal includes adding cameras to the cabins of train conductors, permanent transit bans for people who assault other passengers, and then several initiatives aimed at increasing subway safety and support personnel. One of these initiatives includes turning to a group outside the city's police department for extra help.
Officers at Grand Central Station randomly stopping about every fourth subway rider, asking to check their bag. This part of a new initiative to crack down on subway crime.
It's okay because we know, like, it's for security reasons.
And this feeling was shared by many people who had their bags checked Thursday afternoon.
Oh, no problem at all.
They have saved and, you know, I mean, they're doing a great job.
What was it like getting your bag checked?
Perfectly fine, but the criminals are actually on the subway cars, so get on the cars and ride the subway.
Governor Kathy Hochul announced that she will now be deploying around 750 National Guard members and around 250 state police troopers to conduct random bag searches at some of the city's busiest subway stations. This comes as subway crime is up 13% compared to 2023.
Okay, so that report came from Fox 5 in New York, and it's interesting because it cites a bump in crime on the subway system. When she appeared on MSNBC on Morning Joe, Governor Hochul said that a statistical bump in crime was not actually behind the reasoning for her deploying the National Guard in New York City subways.
But all of us know who've been on the subways. The subways are vast, and we have seen a number of crimes, again, not statistically significant, but psychologically significant. And I want more people to go on the subways.
Governor, by the way, thank you for saying that, because, you know, people will say, oh, crime's at a 50-year low, and everything's wonderful. And then Willie will say, well, why is it that all of my friends say don't go on the subway, or I go into a CVS store and the toothpaste is behind plastic? So thank you. It's not just numbers on the page. No. It's psychologically, do New Yorkers feel safe?
That is exactly what we're trying to fight here. I can show you all the statistics in the world that say you should feel safe because the numbers are better. But you're the mom on the subway with your baby in a stroller. You're the parent putting your kid on the subway to go to high school. You're that senior citizen going to a doctor appointment. If you're anxious that I'm the governor of the state of New York, I'm concerned about it. And if you feel better walking past someone in a uniform to make sure that someone doesn't bring a knife or a gun on the subway, then that's exactly why I did it. I want to change the psychology around crime in New York City because we are the safest big city in America.
Right.
I want people on the subways. It is safe, but I'm going to make sure people feel safe.
She wants to address the psychology of people feeling safe. I am so fascinated by this because I think there is a lot to extrapolate here. I mean, in most major American cities, with the exception of Washington, D.C., which we talked about, you know, you are seeing crime rates go down. But, you know, there is a feeling among a lot of Americans that crime is going up. People feel less safe. And policymakers, leaders like Governor Hochul have to address that. But should perception be driving policymaking?
Yes, to some extent, right? I mean, look, well, there's the reality and then there's what should be. The reality is perception drives politics and politics drives policy. Hmm. And there's never going to be a situation other than that. But having said that, there is something very real to be said about the fact that the way people feel is oftentimes much more important to them than what any statistics show, right? The statistics show this very clearly. Violent crime, property crime are on the decline nationwide. In 2023, violent crime and property crime were lower than at any point during Donald Trump's presidency. Crime is down, but people don't feel it. And so I think it is important, right? I mean, if she wasn't doing anything, then the knock would be, as I think it was Joe Scarborough was saying, that she would be attacked for glossing over people's concerns. So yes, I think that the way people feel is absolutely important. And I don't think it's pandering to tackle it. if you can do it in a way that actually does get to what problem is out there. And so being able to tackle that, I think, is an important role for a leader.
But Mo, when Senator Tom Cotton suggested in an op-ed in the New York Times a few years ago to send the troops in, you know, advocating to bring in the military to deal with what he said were riots around the country, I mean, people on the left freaked out to a point where people lost their jobs at the New York Times for running that op-ed. I know there are differences. Articulate them for me. Why do you see that as different than now we see Governor Hochul and a lot of people, including on the left, are getting behind her and saying great move?
I mean, look, this was at a time that Cotton op-ed was at a time where tensions were really, really, really high. It was published days after President Trump set the military into Lafayette Square. So there was a lot of to clear protesters, not to tackle subway crime, to clear protesters. So I think anxiety was high at the time. I also think that the tone of Senator Cotton's op-ed, you know, the New York Times issued an apology not for running it. It dealt with the fact that he was attacking left-wing Antifa and making a bunch of attacks on people. This is why I think it is different this time. The governor isn't saying that this is a response to one particular group or another. She isn't pitting one group against another. She's simply talking about a policy solution to a particular thing. If that was all Senator Cotton had done back then I think the reaction still would have been different. It still would have been harsh, and the left would have spoken out against it. But I don't think it would have had the same blowback that it did.
Yeah, Mara Gay, editorial board member at the New York Times, back in the Cotton days, said that running the op-ed puts Black people in danger. So she was, you know, saying that there was a real, very sensitive, dangerous race component to this. We should say she has supported Hochul's decision right now. Sarah, you don't have anything to say about this, right?
Oh my gosh, this is a great example of hyperventilation, right? So Cotton does it; it puts Black people in danger. It is actual violence. People were fired from the New York Times. People lost their jobs. And then I agree with Mo that there are people on the left who are concerned about Governor Hochul's policy. And they're like, well, I understand. It's like very calmly worded. We need to think about this. Do we have enough protections in place? Will there be right. racial inequities? And I want to compare it to something else to take it a little bit out of sort of the Trump politics of the whole thing, because I think it will help people, you know, sort of get out of the Trump problem that some folks have, which is we've seen the exact same thing this week and month around the SAT. So 10 years ago, a bunch of universities got rid of the SAT, saying that it was racist. And a whole bunch of people on the right said, you are going to hurt people who go to underprivileged schools. It will hurt people of color. It will hurt poor people, because how else are they supposed to distinguish themselves? And there was once again hyperventilation that those were racist people on the right who would dare defend standardized testing. Well, 10 years later, it turns out it hurts people who go to underprivileged schools. It particularly hurts people of color and poor people who can't distinguish themselves. And when the left writes about this right now and all of these schools reinstitute the SAT, they're saying like, well, we understand that there will be difficulties and we'll need to work around them and et cetera. And again, you can have the same criticism, but not in the same tone. And that's what people are seeing and why it goes to this credibility issue and this hyperventilating issue that when it's Trump, it's the sky is falling immediately. Why can't you see it, you dum-dums? But when it's someone on the left, it's like, well, I have some concerns, but you know what? I think we'll be able to work them out, because, you know, not having crime on the subway is important, and it is really good for people in these communities to feel safe.
I mean, if your point is that people are hypocritical in how they make arguments and how they receive arguments, you're not going to hear any argument from me on that. But let's not pretend or give at all a sense that this is a problem on the left. Right. I mean, this is a problem in politics. Look at the border bill. I mean,
it's specifically about journalists covering it.
The way the people are talking about immigration today, You can point to many examples of this in reverse. The way people are talking about the border bill, the way people are talking about some of these horrible crimes, it's the same thing, right? We all sort of
wait. I don't understand. Judgments. I feel like on the immigration thing, it's been the opposite, that people didn't think immigration was a crisis and Trump was racist for trying to stop immigration at the border and the Remain in Mexico policy. And now it's a nuanced conversation about humanitarian needs at the border.
Well, hold on. I mean, if you're watching Fox News or if you're watching some of the more right of center publications, Dispatch not accepted, you see that there's only one suite of solutions that could possibly stop all of this terrible, terrible violence from streaming across the border. And wait a second, Joe Biden's going to let us do a lot of those things? God, why that this is weak. This is terrible. This isn't at all going to solve the problem, right? I mean, it is the same point you're making in that the media and the political class are doing the same thing.
For the record, I think that they should have published that op-ed.
I know you do.
I mean, I will say that. And I also and that's where I agree to disagree with you. I think you can account for the moment in society and still do your job right as a journalist. But you can't tell a story in a total vacuum. And I think you can. I think you can pull off the balance. But it's a bind. And I hear you. Okay, we are going to turn now to our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah, you want to kick us off?
I've got a personal rant for those of us who worked in the Department of Justice, worked on the Mueller investigation, had the real vitriol and hate coming from Republicans and Democrats. It is pretty annoying to then be told that you're part of Trump world and that you're a never Trumper in the same breath. And it's pretty annoying to see a former coworker get told that the only reason he wrote a report the way he did is because he's, quote, hoping to be appointed to a judicial vacancy by Donald Trump. Do you think Donald Trump likes those of us who worked on the Mueller investigation? Like, trying to paint anyone you disagree with as the other side, the other and partisan, so that your team will hate them, is unhelpful. It's unpatriotic, and people should stop it. Take the ideas as you have them. Stop making enemies out of people because you disagree with them.
All right. Mo?
Amen, Sarah. So this week, the table was formally set. Donald Trump and Joe Biden became their party's presumptive nominees, which leads us to our favorite parlor game in Washington, Veep Stakes. Who are the candidates going to select as their running mates? We know who Joe Biden's going to select, and there have been a lot of names teased for who Donald Trump may get, but neither of them commanded the most attention on this issue this week. It was indeed independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. who teased that his short list right now consists of former independent Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura and NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers. Mm-hmm. Aaron Rodgers, who shares RFK's tendency towards conspiracy theories. RFK Jr. said that his decision will be based on who shares my values and who is ready to step into the job of president on day one. And he's looking at Aaron Rodgers. When the news broke, Aaron Rodgers was on an ayahuasca trip down in Costa Rica. So he didn't even know that his name was about to be floated. We will find out in a couple of weeks when Kennedy pledges to announce his pick. And my guess is it will be just as unserious as this whole exercise has been so far.
Well, also, New York Jets fans probably want to know if he's going to be getting into politics, because can you do both? Well, your Veep Stakes is a nice segue to my rave, which is about Alabama Senator Katie Britt, who, as many of us know, gave the response to President Biden's State of the Union address. I mean, I agree with a lot of what people have said. It was dark. It was weird. I think it was misleading at times. But then we had Saturday Night Live spoof her. Scarlett Johansson did an incredible job in the skit. And I think in our politics today, I assumed that SNL was just going to be trashed by the right, that no one would be able to laugh at stuff like this anymore. But none other than Senator Britt said, you know, that she loved it. She loved that she was played by Scarlett Johansson. She had a great time with the fact that, as she said, here you have Black Widow. They bring in someone from Avengers to play me in the cold open. I'm here for it. And I don't know. I just breathed a sigh of relief that maybe even in these partisan times, SNL can do a great spoof and we can all kind of enjoy it and take a moment. So I'm going to take a moment to say that Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark Hay Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. We're getting into 2024, and we're going to be here for it. Hope you will be, too. Come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.